This is the podcast for JNS Spine. Welcome to the JNS Spine podcast for September 16th, 2011. I'm Natalie Pynchon. I will be reading synopses of some of the articles published today. The article topics in this podcast are the lumbar spine, the cervical spine, and operative technique. Distraction of facets with intra-articular spaces as treatment for lumbar canal stenosis. Report on a preliminary experience with 21 cases. A clinical article by Atul Goel and colleagues. The authors present a novel technique of treatment of lumbar canal stenosis that involves forced introduction of Goel facet spaces within the articular cavity. The operation aims at distraction arthrodesis of the affected spinal segment and is based on the premise that muscle weakness and incompetence leads initially to reduction in facet joint space and later facet telescoping or overriding. All intervertebral ligaments are buckled due to facet override. The reduction of the canal size in degenerative canal stenosis is not a fixed or static phenomenon and appears to be a dynamic process as it is initiated on activity. The facets, rather than the disc, appear to be the primary pathogenic factor that leads to a cascade of changes, culminating into spondylotic or degenerative spinal canal stenosis. Distraction of the facets affects immediate widening of the bony spinal and intervertebral root canal. The procedure resulted in reduction of buckling of the ligamentum flavum, and the extent of bulge of the disc into the spinal canal, leading to dramatic relief from symptoms. The described operation does not involve removal of any part of the bone, ligament, or disc. The authors report their successful clinical experience with treatment of 21 cases between April 2006 and January 2011. The average follow-up was 17 months. Novel reduction technique for thoracolumbar fracture dislocations. A technical note by Timothy Moore and colleagues. Little is written about how to reduce thoracolumbar dislocations. These injuries are typically stabilized by burring of the superior articular facets of the caudal vertebrae and holding the reduction by segmental pedicle screw instrumentation. Moore and colleagues present a reproducible and reliable method for reducing these injuries that maintains the bony anatomy that lends stability across the fracture segment. In this article, the authors have included an intraoperative video of the reduction maneuver. The acute motor-sensory axonal neuropathy variant of Guillain-Barré syndrome after thoracic spine surgery. A case report by Jocelyn Cheng and co-authors. Guillain-Barré syndrome is the eponym for acute inflammatory polyradicular neuropathy. It typically presents with the acute onset of ascending weakness, sensory impairment, diminished reflexes, and albuminocytologic dissociation of the CSF. Cranial neuropathies may occur. Electromyography and nerve conduction studies typically show demyelinating changes, although axonal loss may be present. While Guillain-Barré syndrome is often associated with preceding infection, it has also been reported postoperatively without a clear preceding infection. The authors describe the case of a patient in whom Guillain-Barré syndrome developed after she underwent thoracic meningioma resection. A 59-year-old woman was admitted for a T1 to 3 meningioma resection. Her baseline examinations showed brisk reflexes and grade 4-5 strength in the left leg. A lumbar drain was placed after surgery for improved CSF drainage. Postoperatively, the patient acutely developed distal, greater than proximal, weakness of her arms and legs, length-dependent sensory impairment, decreased reflexes, and corticobulbar weakness. Cerebrospinal fluid studies revealed persistent albuminocytologic dissociation. Nerve conduction studies and electromyographic findings were consistent with primary axonal loss. Based on these findings, the patient was diagnosed with the acute motor-sensory axonal neuropathy variant of Guillain-Barré syndrome. Although rare in the postoperative setting, inflammatory polyradicular neuropathy should be considered in the differential diagnosis of acute flaccid quadriparesis with length-dependent sensory dysfunction. Anterior dural ectasia mimicking a lytic lesion in the posterior vertebral body in ankylosing spondylitis. A case report by Kirtiraj Bell and co-authors. Ankylosing spondylitis is a seronegative spondyloarthropathy predominantly affecting the axial skeleton. Spinal fractures, rotary instability, progressive spinal deformity, and spinal canal stenosis lead to neurological complications. In this case, 14 years after ankylosing spondylitis started in a patient, he presented with Cowder-Aquina syndrome. Magnetic resonance images of the dorsolumbar spine revealed an ectatic dural sac eroding the posterior part of the L1 vertebral body predominantly and L2 vertebral body minimally. The sac revealed a few septi within, extension of nerve roots into it, and adherence of nerve roots to the dura. Symptomatic dural ectasia in association with ankylosing spondylitis is infrequent. Nerve root damage in this disease occurs due to arachnoiditis and/or compression by expansive arachnoid diverticula, with the spread of local enthesitis to meninges, resulting in local inflammation of the arachnoid membranes, with subsequent nerve root inflammation, degeneration, fibrosis, adhesion, and tethering. Inflammation and arachnoid diverticula establish a slowly progressive process leading to bony erosion. Comprehensive imaging differentiates between syndromic dural ectasia and lytic bony lesions. Surgical options for Cowder-Aquina syndrome have so far been described only for anterior dural ectasia and include decompressive laminectomy, detethering of the cord, and lumboperitoneal shunting. The authors state that the best surgical option for an anterior dural diverticulum remains a matter of speculation. Association of magnetic resonance imaging signal changes and outcome prediction after surgery for cervical spondylotic myelopathy. A clinical article by Aditya Vedantam and co-workers. In the present study, the authors reviewed magnetic resonance images of 197 patients to determine whether the type of T2 weighted change in the cervical cord was an independent predictor of outcome following anterior decompressive surgery for cervical spondylotic myelopathy or ossification of the posterior longitudinal ligament. The T2 weighted cord changes were labeled as type 0 if there was no change, type 1 for a fuzzy, ill-defined hyperintensity, and type 2 for a sharp, distinct hyperintensity. The presence of T1-weighted hypointensity was also noted. One of the outcome measures used was cure, which was defined as a follow-up neuric grade of 0 or 1. The key findings of this study are that although type 1 changes are common on magnetic resonance images of the cervical spine, they carry little or no prognostic significance. In addition, the presence of type 2 change and a preoperative neuric grade of 4 or 5 significantly reduced the probability of cure after surgery. If patients had a T1-weighted hypointensity in addition to the type 2 change, their chance of cure was further reduced. The authors state that the results of this study will help surgeons in the preoperative counseling of their patients planned for decompressive surgery for cervical spondylotic myelopathy. Thank you for listening. JNSPG podcast content is now contained in the newly launched American Association of Neurological Surgeons iTunes U site. Sign up in iTunes for our podcasts and additional content, including video content and podcasts from the AANS, all updated continuously. To read all the articles published by the Journal of Neurosurgery this week, or to listen to more podcasts, please visit us at thejns.org. You can also follow the JNS on Twitter.